Welcome to the Access Advocacy Podcast. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. I'm so excited to have Tiana Wolford, and she has blessed us with her company, and she's going to tell us all about her journey with sickle cell. Tiana.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be here. It has been a very long journey, so I don't even know where to start, but I'm grateful for this opportunity. And I guess we can't really talk about my organization until we've talked about kind of what led me into this space. I'm 30 years old. I just turned 30 last week, and about 10, 11 years ago, I had a bone marrow transplant, and it really happened because I was at a point of desperation where I was just in and out of the hospital, and I didn't think I could live the quality of life that I wanted to live if I still had sickle cell. So I was approached about doing a bone marrow transplant. And I got on the Be the Match registry, and like so many of us, I did not have a perfect match. So I really kind of gave up on the dream of being cured from sickle cell. And then my mother, who was a nursing professor at the time, one of her students approached her about a clinical trial that was happening at NIH and Johns Hopkins, where they were doing research on half match transplants. So we didn't really know a lot of information about it. But again, I was really at a point of desperation, and so was my family. We had just been suffering for years in and out of the hospital. So we went in for a consult, and I went through the informed consent process, and I think that I wasn't even retaining the potential risk because I could only think about being cured. But what I did know was that I did not want to be infertile. I wanted a lot of children. And I knew that the chemotherapy and the radiation could leave me infertile. So when I expressed that to the doctor, his response was, "I don't know why you'd be worried about this transplant making you infertile, because with all the complications you've had from sickle cell, you're probably already infertile anyway." Mm-hmm. And I remember only being 19 and just being devastated. But in my mind, if I could get cured from sickle cell, then I was willing to trade having biological children. But long story short, I rejected that transplant. So 10 years later, dealing with the fallout and still having sickle cell and being infertile, it's a little bit more difficult than I imagined it would be. But what I know is that it's actually not a fair trade-off. You should be able to be cured and still have the option for biological children. So that's kind of a little bit of background about what started my organization.
Well, I just want to mention to the audience that this was very early on in the haplo transplant, and that's where you have a half match. Mm-hmm. And we can get half matches from a mother, a father, or a sibling. And there are several trials going on now, but that was really, 10 years ago was really very early on. And when I hear you say this, it's you're thinking it was your last chance, but it still was an amazingly brave thing for you to do at that point. I also believe that because of the work you've done in your advocacy work prior to starting your organization, it has really helped people create a more informed consent. And it's another thing I heard you say was, you're thinking that you wanted to live and you would be cured, and it was okay for you to make that trade. And I think this is another thing that I see in the patients that I follow who have had transplants, that some have failed, some have been great. It still takes a while, right? Even if you have a transplant, it takes at least a year, I think, to really see what that is and see what it was, the full cost of it.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad that you did kind of reiterate the fact that it was 10 years ago, because I get asked that all the time, like, would I do it again? Would I recommend it for others? And I think people expect me to answer that from a place of bitterness because of what happened to me, but it was 10 years ago. So I think that the science has come a long way. Unfortunately, we have not made a tremendous amount of progress in that advocacy space. And when I say that, I mean, I still don't think that there's enough focus on the mental toll that a transplant can have, not just if you reject, because in that instance, you're having to grieve a dream for yourself of being cured. But then even if you are successful, that comes with something too. That's from my understanding, because you've been used to living with sickle cell, so then trying to navigate and reconcile what it means to be sickle cell free. Some people have expressed they feel like they don't have any identity outside of sickle cell. So we need to have more conversations about that. And then 10 years ago, even though that doctor told me that I was probably already infertile, of course I did my own research, and fertility preservation was just not accessible to me. And
I just want to say, not accessible to you as a sickle cell patient.
Exactly.
It has been part of other transplant programs.
Exactly. And that's what really disturbed me and motivated me to take some action in this space. Because what happened was, I failed to get follow-up care from my transplant team for 10 years. And it took my getting a new hematologist to come into the picture and say, hey, why hasn't the transplant team followed up with you? Like, I had had cancer scares and everything and had not heard from them. And so what happened when I finally did have that follow-up care, we tested my hormone levels. And they were so terrible that my hematologist called me in the middle of the day, and she was like, I haven't known you that long, but just from what I do observe of you, I think that you want children, and you're headed into a direction where that will not be possible, because like your AMH, your hormone levels are very, very low. So she said, and I also want to make it clear that those levels are not just low because of the transplant. That didn't help, but it was also because I stayed on hydroxyurea, which most people don't. But transfusions, like, I don't have that luxury because of all the antibodies. So it was also the combination of hydroxyurea and disease progression that have made my ovarian reserve low. So she said that we needed to have conversations about fertility preservation. And it was shocking to me that we were still in the same place we were 10 years ago, that when you go to Google and you look for grants for sperm banking or egg freezing, there's so many grants, but you have to have a diagnosis of cancer. So I just had this idea that I would start this foundation. You know, I have a lot of resources. I would start this foundation and we would give away grants to any warrior who was pursuing gene therapy or stem cell transplant. And when I discussed that with my hematologist, she was excited about it. But she said, I feel like that just kind of puts a Band-Aid on it, and that it's more of like a reproductive justice and inequity issue. And so we needed to focus on advocating to get the laws changed so that insurance covers it. And we know that over 60% of families with sickle cell are covered by Medicaid.
Yes.
So that's something that we decided we need to work on. And it's not going to be easy, and it's going to take all of us. So I'm working on putting a coalition together. And then the two of us got together with Dr. Kim Smith-Whitley, who really kind of opened my eyes to the fact that when you talk about reproductive health and sickle cell, it's not just about fertility. It starts with delayed puberty, delayed growth, pregnancy, priapism, menopause, hormones, all of those things. So what I thought would just be about fertility has really grown into this whole umbrella of reproductive health. And it's really interesting to me that there are so many organizations and they do wonderful things, but none of them really hone in on reproductive health. So it's a large undertaking, and the name of my organization, it's the Sickle Cell Reproductive Health Education Directive, which is an incredibly long name.
But it's a perfect name.
Well, we call it SCRED for short, and yes. I think that's pretty easy to remember.
Yes. I just want to say, you know, as a mother of female, my thoughts about my child's health, you know, was always her life first. And in thinking of her life first, as far as her reproductive health, my thoughts really had to do more with if she too much blood loss, right? It had to do with her hormone levels, which I would be frightened about because she was taking so many meds, and the fear that when she would go and they would do like a physical or anything like that, I would say, well, why aren't you checking this? Because there would be all these mood swings and things like that. And I don't know, normal, if there is a normal, but a lot of times you just chalk that up to being female and it's supposed to be that way. And so even in our many, many discussions about things, we did not ever really talk about reproductive rights for further in her life.
Right.
And I know the fear I had at one point where she was so sick that, oh my God, you know, would she even survive a pregnancy?
Yeah.
And so I know for many caregivers, like parents and stuff, our radar. And so the fact that you're talking about this education piece is so very important, because it will talk about reproductive health, not just as your hematologist said, not just reproduction, but health, which of course all of it has to do with our health. All of us have to do with, I don't want to say being normal, but I think it is obtaining that optimal state of health that
exactly.
You can.
Exactly. And I'm glad that you made that point, and that you're not unique in that way. It's not even just the families. We have providers who don't even have these conversations about reproductive health. It really wasn't until I founded this organization that I even realized how isolating it was that I did experience delayed puberty. But these were not conversations that we were having. And I think because people are so familiar in the community with my story, when they first heard I was doing this organization, there was an assumption that it was just fertility and pregnancy, but it's not. Like, you don't even have to want to have a child, but reproductive health touches all of us. And our ultimate goal is to advocate for high quality reproductive health care. So we want reproductive health to be standard of care. I know that it's easy and it makes sense that we prioritize a vaso-occlusive crisis, chronic pain, organ damage, but we need to be adding on reproductive health to these conversations.
Oh, absolutely. And I think especially now that we have new treatments coming, I mean, I think it's safe to say that stem cells manipulation, I'm going to use that word, really are shining star out bright out there to us as being maybe providing us an ultimate cure. But if you're damaged, your body is not healthy, having a transplant at that point, or stem cell manipulation or regeneration, it's not going to help you in those senses, in that sense. So you have to more than ever really, really try to preserve your health and stay in, as healthy as you can. And that means being educated, because for many people, thinking past that that crisis or acute chest or stroke, you know, just the bandwidth for things to think about. And now we have that. Now we have the treatments. Now we have so many more opportunities. And therefore, this mindset that many families, I mean, have it, and providers have it, that why have these conversations? You know, everything is through that lens of sickle cell and pain.
Yeah.
And what we're doing and what you're doing is to change that, to really see the whole person. And I want you to talk a little bit about the people who are helping you do this, because that, for a fresh starting organization, it is quite impressive.
It is quite impressive. And that's what lets me know that this work is so important, because I have people from all walks of life, all different kinds of stakeholders helping me do this. I think that everyone in our community is familiar with Dr. Kim Smith-Whitley, who's been this world-renowned pediatric hematologist. But what people don't realize about her until you really get into the weeds with her through conversation or through a Google search is that she has been a champion for women's health and sickle cell for the last 10 years. And you can Google and look at different publications that she's done on protocols for pregnant women and different things like that. And then Dr. Lydia Pecker, who people may not be as familiar with, but she's one of the few hematologists to research fertility in sickle cell. And not just research it, but she really is going out of her way to get data into the literature and put things in black and white. So those are just my co-founders. And then when I look at my board, I have Dr. Marzady, who we all know, who's chairing my board.
Yes, Dr. Z.
Phil is an amazing advocate. And that's what I really like about it. And then we have this amazing advisory committee that you're on. And I have a steering committee of warriors and caregivers. And we've already gotten so much support, even outside of the sickle cell community. And that's what I really like about it. I think that it's groundbreaking in a way that we have all these people sitting at the same table. I've never really seen this before, where we have patients and doctors this invested in one organization, but it just kind of solidifies the importance of this ever-evolving space. And then another thing that I wanted to go back to, because we are talking about preserving and prioritizing fertility preservation, I wanted to make it clear, because there was a bit of a scare. One of my co-founders published a paper that showed that hydroxyurea and disease progression cause low ovarian reserve. And I did get calls asking, like, should I stop taking my hydroxyurea? And what I want people to know is that we are not advocating that you stop taking treatments that could impact your fertility. But as an organization, we are working above and beyond to make fertility preservation more accessible to this community. So I just wanted to add that disclaimer about hydroxyurea.
Yeah, I know that women in the community who want to be moms and are on hydroxyurea will be under their doctor's watch, will stop taking hydroxyurea for a certain amount of time before they even begin to start trying to get pregnant again. So that's really is an important point that you've made. I got one more question about this. So what else is really wonderful is, I know when we start talking about reproductive health that your mind first goes to women.
Yeah.
Right? and how women wanted to be mothers and right. So part of the reason there's so much understanding and support for your mission is most people really resonate with a woman wanting to be a mother. But the fact that you're also including our male warriors who have suffered so much, mm-hmm. I mean, and really are and start at a very young age, that you're including them and their health in this and their preserving their ability to be a parent if they so choose. How have the guys responded to you?
It was actually because of feedback that I was getting from the males in this community and observations that I was making on social media and conversations that I was having with other advocates like Cassandra Trimnell from Sickle Cell 101. When we get questions about reproductive health, they're more so coming from the guys because they're wanting to know how to talk to their partner about priapism or erectile dysfunction and just how isolating and how depressing that can be. And when I realized how much they were suffering, it was just no way that we could leave them out of the conversation. And that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm so excited, because reproductive health really does touch everyone. So there really is a place for everyone, regardless of your gender, your age, your sexual orientation. There's a place for everyone in this organization.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
So we just quickly, I want to talk about preservation, because a lot of people don't understand that process. I think we hear about males, and most of the time, you know, it's kind of a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah, you go to the clinic and you get something to hold the sperm in and a book and you go.
Right.
And it's always kind of he kind of, you know, yeah. Kind of in the sitcoms. So let's walk through really what that process looks like for, we'll talk about for female.
Okay, yeah. Well, like you were saying, it's a little bit more simplistic for the guys as far as that initial semen analysis and banking. It's still not easily accessible, though, because while that initial banking may not be that much, you get into the annual storage fees and all of that.
Right,
but for women, it's a little bit more complex, and it depends on the age. So, like, for girls who are premenarchal, which is before they've started their cycle, that process, unfortunately, it's pretty invasive. And they actually have to remove a whole ovary. And what I found, though, from talking to families is that they are willing to go through that if it means that they can have grandchildren in the future. So right now, if you're premenarchal, that's your only option is to freeze your ovarian tissue. But then if you're past that age, then that is when you go through the process to stimulate your follicles to produce as many eggs as possible and then freeze those eggs. And I forgot to mention, for the guys, the ones who have not started puberty yet, it's research, and they can only preserve tissue as well. But like I said, I've had conversations with families. There's a doctor in Pittsburgh who really leads this research, and he says that he gets hundreds of families flocking to him to do this research. So it's not really the most pleasant thing to go through, but I think that people are able to kind of look at the bigger picture.
Yes, yes. And I think, again, that we have that picture now with confidence that our warriors as mothers and fathers would be alive to do those things. It wasn't that way. It was not that way when my brother was born. It was not that way when Marissa was born. It was sort of a discussion, well, you know, we're going to do all these things, and yes, she should have the best life she can, but the majority of care providers, particularly when she was young, I don't want to say hinted, but sort of couched discussions mm-hmm. with her having a limited, you know, lifespan. And now those conversations aren't happening.
Right.
Now they're conversations about optimal health and treatments, not nearly enough of those. And I think all of us in the advocacy world are working towards changing that.
Right. And that's, yeah, exactly. And so I think that historically sickle cell was kind of like a pediatric illness because we were not surviving. But now that we are, it's definitely time to have conversations about quality of life and not just surviving with this disease, but thriving, because we've already run into a little bit of pushback in the advocacy space of like, why would you even need to have these conversations about people wanting to have children? You guys are so sick or you're so poor. And it's like, no, we're just like everybody else. And, you know, we want those same rights that everyone else has. So, and I think that the timing of this organization could not have come at a better time either, because I think the country is more primed to have conversations about inequity and disparities. So a lot of times you hear that there's no support in the sickle cell community. And I have to be honest with you, we've had people come to our table that we didn't even know they knew that we were out there, because they want to help and they believe in this so much. And I forgot to mention, as a part of my team, we also have these world-renowned endocrinologists for peds and adults who have done this work for the cancer population and have come to us to ask how they can be helpful to the sickle cell community. So I think the timing is impeccable.
Yes. And I remember sitting as we would be at the cancer center and for infusion and pain management, and they would have these great displays and they would offer all of these things, right? They would have a wellness center. You could go from the fourth floor to the fifth floor. Mm-hmm. There were always counselors available. There were crafting circles, yoga, retreats fully paid for. I mean, it was amazing what was available. But for us, there was none of that.
Exactly.
And I think that that has changed. It is changing. We don't have, we're not there yet.
Right.
But I think you're right as the awareness. And I think of us really speaking out about the situation. And I know you've mentioned the equity conversation. Mm-hmm. And I know for so long we have talked about things, how we're treated when we go in to the ER, when once we're on the floor. And a lot of times people will take that as thinking it's more like one-off. That's just your story. But now with everything that's going on and the awareness level, there is support, there is awareness, there is, I think, making it harder and harder to deny our truth.
Exactly.
And with that comes other possibilities, the ability to I think, think about it when you say, we didn't have anything of like this available to us, and have them go, not just really, but, mm-hmm. oh yeah, we know, and that's not right, and how can we help?
Exactly.
So tell us again the name of this wonderful organization.
The full name is the Sickle Cell Reproductive Health Education Directive, but we're happy to be known as SC Red. I worked very hard to come up with that very cute and creative name.
It is.
And you can go to our website. We're very proud of our website. It's www.sicklecellred.org.
And I wouldn't be comfortable with us having this discussion without talking about your amazing support system. So let's talk about your grandmom.
Oh, yeah. My grandparents, my mother, yeah, it's amazing. My mom, she was interested in sickle cell long before she knew she would have me. She did a huge research project on this in fifth grade, and then her nursing dissertation was on sickle cell. So I came into a family who knew a little bit about sickle cell and also understood when I was born that we would have to make some adjustments and that we would have to advocate. And I appreciate them because they never let me use sickle cell as a crutch. And they kind of taught me that I could do anything I wanted to do. I just may have to do it differently. But I mean, I don't know who I would be or where I would be without my support system, my family, my church, the sickle cell community. I have a lot of support here as well. So, and I know that I'm privileged in that way. I know that there are some who don't have that support system. And what I want to say to them is that you can find support in the sickle cell community. There's a huge following, a huge presence on social media of people who will rally behind you. So I just want to add that too.
Yes, the benefit of the found family, right? The collective. Yeah. And even for me, and people have heard me say it over and over again, that found family that understands,
yeah,
right, has really helped carry me, not just support, you know, Marissa, but to carry me and to encourage me and help in ways that, you know, I never ever imagined.
Right.
And so I think your organization and your journey is an example of that. That combination of the blood family,
right,
and the found family that can come together at the right time, you know, and make amazing things happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us a bit about some of the plans you have. So we've seen the things that you, what's important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some thoughts about your plans.
Okay, well, thank you for that opportunity because we have a lot to be proud of already. And I do have to say that I have an amazing team. So it's not been that I've been able to accomplish this all on my own, but it's not premature enough. I mean, it's far enough along that I can talk about it that we already have a partnership with Be the Match. They are helping us in two aspects. They're helping us with legislation and they're helping us on the philanthropic side as well. So, you know, like I said, initially my dream was just to be able to give away grants. And that's something that Be the Match is going to help us do. So we've made progress in advocacy already. As far as support, we would like to position ourselves in the future to be able to have our own grant money so that we can cover things that may not be covered in the Be the Match grant, like storage fees and things like that. And then we're going to be having support groups because I do think that conversations around priapism, fertility, that's pretty taxing mentally. And then there's the huge education piece that I think is really going to be our year one. And not just education on what reproductive health means, but how do you apply that into your daily life? Like, how do you have conversations about trait or on a first date? Or do you have it on the first date? Conversations like that. And how do you talk to your partner about priapism or pain with sex? That comes up all the time on social media. And, you know, a lot of this I'm learning as I go. So we'll need input from the sickle cell community about exactly what the needs are. But I do think that we have, as an organization, the energy and the resources to meet those needs. So those are just some of the plans, and we're still fleshing it out. But I'm excited about the potential of what we'll be able to accomplish.
One of the surprising things for me was when I learned how much of our advocacy work has to, if we're going to make real changes, revolves around policy and legislation. You know, I thought, I don't know, I mean, I was very naive, I think. I sort of thought things like, well, you have insurance, you know, or you have, of course, there are laws, but there are laws to make the, you know, so that people would do the right thing, and you're in America, so you have the right to have, you know, good care. Mm. And the division, I think, or the selectiveness of who gets what was really mind-blowing for me.
Yeah.
Right? Because it would seem that if I had a group of humans who had certain conditions, and I said that group of humans have this these conditions, and therefore they deserve to have A, B, C, and D, that any other group of humans that have those conditions should have A, B, C, and D, because it's the human state. And the other shock for me was the cost to get a policy and legislation done. That was huge to me. I thought, well, I mean, you go and you give testimony and you say this is, and proof maybe even, and you write something, but it's the amount of times you have to go and give testimony. It's the type of proof. I mean, if you need to have an economist, you need to have a health economist, you need to have the research, the health research. If you're talking about any type of equipment, that's another whole different type. And then there are all these other organizations that look at it. There's the FDA, there's the CDC, all of these things that we don't grow up understanding. And it's not just us, but I think, you know, the average person living yeah. in this country, we don't grow up understanding that. And it is part of the journey or education that you have to go through trial and fire, so to speak, in order to get something done. And I'm like hoping that, you know, in a world, it'll be simpler. Don't look at me like that.
No, really, it's simpler. Just, yeah, no, I, because what you're saying is true. It goes back into this thing of equity, because there are laws in place for fertility preservation and there are mandates, but not if you're on Medicaid. And I, you know, I have to be honest and fully transparent. When it comes to legislation and policy, I'm like, not that girl, but I'm kind of getting my feet wet. And what you're saying is incredibly true. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort. And I've already had conversations where people are like, you know, you're not going to get this to pass. It's just not going to happen. But you know the kind of person I am. I don't really take no when it comes to the sickle cell community. So that's another good thing, is that we've already had meetings with the CDC and ASH. And so we have people, we have the right stakeholders at the table who recognize that we need to push this work forward.
Absolutely. And again, where you had mentioned before the timing, I think the timing is great. And I think that our community in the past 5 years has just blown up.
Blown up.
I think the communication between the groups, which before was, I mean, really poor. But now we have groups that are being very transparent and very helpful and saying, oh, you know, this is happening here. This piece of legislation is happening there. I mean, my dream is that we have our very own lobbyists that really, you know, helps us even to the point where we have someone in every state, an ombudsman or some officer or something like that, you know, that would be basically aware of, informed, and devoted to our platform, mm-hmm. to what we need, right? And we have a solidified platform from the national to the state level, so that there's not so much difference from state to state on things, right? If we right. could just have a national position on sickle cell and what we need, kind of like, I don't know, it's naive, but kind of like stroke, you know?
Yeah.
You have a stroke, there's a protocol, you have to do these things. Many of the cancer centers have absolutely have the same things. Now, yeah. The quality may be different, but as far as the choices and the position of what the patient deserves, mm-hmm. right, is shared.
Right.
And that's really what I want.
Right. And what you want, I mean, it sounds incredibly ambitious and like a huge stretch, but honestly, again, to timing, we are fresh off of the release of the NASEM report that my co-founder, Dr. Kim Smith-Whitley, spent hours working on that you and I contributed to. And that's really what it is. It's a blueprint. And all of that is tied in about legislation and policies that should be in place. And they've taken from other disease communities and said, look, we need the same things. And so it's the timing is perfect with that NASEM report. And then what you said earlier about having these different voices together, I think that that's something that's not celebrated enough. And it's something that as an advocate, I try to convey because I really do hear a lot from sickle cell warriors that sickle cell is overlooked and undervalued, but and that's, they're not wrong about that. But what I want to stress is that, you know, as advocates, I've had seats at tables from not just sickle cell, but rare diseases.
Right.
And I've never seen anything like what we have in the sickle cell community. I mean, at any given day, there are probably 20 hematologists that I could call day or night, and I know that they're up thinking about how to make our lives better. And it's not just doctors. It is people in legislation. There are people in the Black Caucus. There are industry partners.
Yes.
I've never seen this level of collaboration and this like sense of urgency that I see now. So I know that, you know, in the past, it's been kind of dismal, but I think that the future is very promising.
Yeah, we're in a new day.
Exactly.
This is Tiana Woodford, and you are so, what can I say, fortunate to have heard her today, and she is doing big things and even bigger things, and is a true example of, hey, warrior power. So thank you. We're going to make sure that we're letting everyone know about the activities of her wonderful organization with the really cute name of...
SC Red.
Thank you. Thank you, Tiana.
Thank you.
You can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXIS advocacy.org. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.